Welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on admiralty when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, law school professor at Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed, and it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. Now, remember, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Admiralty. We hear a lot about admiralty in patriot circles. People talk about admiralty courts and admiralty process and admiralty flags and admiralty this and admiralty that and so on. What is it? Has anybody ever taken a look at this animal called admiralty and dissected it a little bit? I'm not sure that the average patriot out there knows half as much as he thinks he knows about this thing called admiralty. It's quite a little topic. Admiralty is a little different than the common law. They've got that right. But I'm not sure that the average Joe Sixpack American knows what the common law is, where it came from, or what its history is. And I'm not sure that the average Joe Sixpack American patriot knows very much about admiralty or where it comes from or what its roots are or how it works or why it works that way. We have a process here in America called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. My personal opinion is I'd not like to be in an admiralty court or in a military court if it's at all possible. I'd like to avoid that. I would like to have justice, and justice comes from the common law. In fact, in the Bible, God talks about justice quite often. In fact, very often. And he says there's no justice in the land. Over and over and over, he complains that there's no justice in the land. He's not talking about America today in 2006. It certainly includes America in 2006, but that's not what he was aiming at. He was aiming at, in the days of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and all the prophets, clear up to Malachi, he says there's no justice in the land. They're just bloody crimes. There's all kinds of filth and perversity. There's theft and lying and rape and robbery and pillage. And he complained that the way of peace they know not. Just take a look at the Middle East and ask yourself, does George Bush and George Cheney, do they know about, or Dick Cheney rather, do they know about peace? Do they understand the laws that govern peace in the land? Hell, we don't even have peace in the United States. We used to have peace here in our country, but we don't even have peace here anymore. So the conclusion that I come to is that the way of peace they know not. And that's certainly an accurate statement. And I could go on and say, the way of justice they know not, because there's no justice in the land. And the reason that there's no justice is because we don't have a justice system. We have an adversarial system. It's adversarial. And because it's an adversary system, we have advocates. You know, that you watch on television and they have JAG. They have the JAG guys come in there. The advocate's office. These guys are advocates. They're not looking for justice. They're looking for an adversary. And then they don't hide it. I'd like to have a justice system where I can get justice, but That's not to be had here in the United States because we have this adversarial system. And people, they get real uptight about that, and they get into the traffic court, and they jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and they scream and yell, and they say, I'm a citizen, I'm a sovereign, I've got rights. And I'm not so sure that most of these people that are jumping up and down in court claiming that they've got rights have rights. I'm not saying that they don't. There may be some of these people in here that actually have some rights and simply don't know how to advance their claim of rights. But honest to God, I don't believe that 99.44% of these people have rights to advance when they walk into court to start with. And I'd like to share that with you and tell you why. I think these people all have Siemens papers. I think they have Siemens papers. But before we get to Siemens papers and we get into the nitty-gritty of this thing called admiralty and why it is that it works against us most times, you know, in court, let's take a look from AMJUR, American Jurisprudence, on the subject of admiralty. There's 233 sections on admiralty. Sometimes people want to know, how can you be so sure that there's 233? Well, I just looked here at the index, and it says right here, 233. Just looked it right up, and it starts off. And it talks about remedies and admiralty practice and procedure and Public Vessels Act and Suits and Admiralty Act, maritime services cases, tort jurisdiction, in personam and in rem jurisdiction, saving to suitors clause. You ever wonder about the savings to suitors clause? I know people will walk into court, and I've seen it myself, and they'll jump up and down and demand their rights under the common law, which comes from this clause in the Constitution that provides for savings to suitors clause. And there's about one, see, I'm going to count them up here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's 10 sections that deal with the savings to suitors clause. And it would seem like to me that if you walked into a traffic court and you wanted a common law remedy, if you wanted an outlaw remedy for your claim to rights in that court, that you would have to first file a motion to advance the savings to suitors clause in order to bring the subject matter of law before the court. I've never heard of anybody doing that. But it would seem like to me that out of all this paper that I read, you know, that comes from these patriot groups, which is primarily just trash, and it you can see that it's trash by the fact that the judges don't listen to them. I mean, after all, you know, if the judge is looking at a piece of paper and it doesn't have any legal merit, then he dismisses it. He overrules it. He doesn't listen to it. He doesn't implement it. He doesn't give you what you want. That ought to be a clue that something's not right here. So I try to avoid that. When I walk into court, I got to tell a story here. I was doing a case 2 or 3 years ago, kind of a big case. To me, it was a big case. It had a lot of property involved in it. And I had 214 exhibits to put into evidence. 214 pieces of paper. And this case drug on for several months. In fact, the whole case was about 3 years in duration, but just trying the case, you know, lasted over several months. And 214, and I had an attorney that I was working with here, a standby counsel is what we call him. I'd hired this guy, and he's a pretty nice guy, very knowledgeable guy, came from Harvard. And I said, now I've got these 214 exhibits, and while I'm hiring you and I'm paying you, I want you to go over these 214 exhibits with me. And I want you to give me your opinion as to which ones are relevant and which ones are irrelevant. And see, there's 42 rules that we have to follow here, 42 objections, in which there are 10 hearsay exceptions. And my opponent's going to object to the introduction of these pieces of evidence, and I have to overcome that. And so we went through it, and he came down to 60 out of 214. He says, you can't get these in. 60 out of 214, let's just divide that one out. 60 divided by 214, is that what percent? He said 28% of these, a fourth of them, aren't going to get in. Now, I had gone over those very carefully myself, and I analyzed each and every one of them before I ever brought it to his attention. And I had the rule that they followed and that I was going to argue. And when it was all said and done, we got down on the bottom line. He was right, I think it was 9 times. Let's try that one. 9 divided by 214. Well, it was 4%, 0.04%, 0.042% to be exact. 9 out of 214 I couldn't get in. I think I could argue those 9 in the appellate process and said the judge erred when he didn't let these in, or he abused his discretion when he left these out, or something on that order. But the moral to the story is this, that if you follow the rules, you know, you'll most likely succeed. Most likely succeed. And the guy that plays this game by the rules is the guy that does it the best. Now, you're going into an admiralty court, not always, but, you know, sometimes you can walk into a federal district court and the judge has 3 hats. He has an admiralty hat, a common law hat, and an equity hat. Congress gave him those 3 hats to wear. I remember old Judge Clark told me that one time. He says, I got 3 hats up here to wear. I wear my admiralty hat, I wear my equity hat, or I wear my law hat. And they call it the law hat. They're referring to the common law. So you can have you can have some common law proceedings in federal court under the Seventh Amendment. Remember, you're entitled to a jury trial in all matters in excess of $20. And I've had people say, well, I can't get a jury in this case here as it relates to $20 over here. And that's true. See, in admiralty courts, you don't get a jury trial. And if you do, you get an advisory jury. There was a case called the Ugly Anchor Woman case, and she was in Kansas City. And this lady had been the anchor woman at this TV station for a number of years. And as she got older, they decided that they needed younger blood. You know, they wanted a young woman in there instead of this old lady. They didn't want a Barbara Walters. I'm not quite sure why they wanted to change like this. I personally, if I was going to listen to an anchor woman, I'd kind of like to listen to a Barbara Walters rather than a Britney Spears. But, you know, sex is what sells, and I guess that's what they were after. Well, anyway, this lady had been canned. You know, she took offense at that, and so she sued. And the jury awarded her a certain amount of money. I forgot, $500,000. And the judge set the judgment aside, said it was excessive. And then it was reported this was an advisory jury. So right away, that tells you right there that we're not dealing at common law here. We're not dealing under the Seventh Amendment. We're not dealing with savings to suitors or we're not dealing with the common law as it relates to a jury trial in all matters over $20. Now, why isn't this jury verdict binding in this case? Well, because this woman over here, there's something different about her. I'm sure that she went to public school, and I'm sure that she went in there and said, well, I'm an American citizen, I'm a voter, and I've got rights. But, you know, all you have to do is watch the outcome of it, and you can see that I'm sure this woman was an American citizen, and I'm sure she was a voter, but she didn't have these rights that she thought she had. And I think a lot of people out there think that they've got rights that they really don't have. And so I'm going to explain to you, well, here's why. You're an American citizen, and you've got a driver's license and registration, letters after your name, you've been to college, you're a somebody, you got a job, you're making a lot of money, you probably vote. But you don't have rights. You may have privileges, you may have some immunities, you may have some permits, but you don't have rights. And as a result of this rights issue, you don't have property. And without property, you can't have rights, because admiralty doesn't deal with property. Admiralty doesn't deal with property. The common law deals with property. And I'm not sure that very many Americans, now I'm not saying that none of you have any property, but I don't know of very many Americans that have property. I know of a lot of Americans that claim that they have property, believe they have property, use property, jump up and down and claim they have property, but I look at it and I apply the law to it, and I don't think so. I think they're practicing the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. I think they're practicing the abolition of all right to property, and that they have a chosen action, or they have an equitable right of interest or possessory right to somebody else's property. Kind of like renting a Hertz car. And you're driving this Hertz car, and so the question comes up, well, who owns this car? And you say, well, I own this car. And I can see that you're in possession of it, and I can see that you're driving it, and I can see that you've got the keys to it. But I don't think that's your car. I think it belongs to the Hertz Corporation. Now, if we dug a little deeper and we asked the question, well, does the Hertz Corporation own this car? I'm sure that they would say, yes, this is a property right, and we own that property over there. I would take issue with that. I don't think the Hertz Company owns that car either. Because on the front and on the back of that car, there's a little piece of tin called a license plate. And it'll have a state's identification on there, like Iowa or North Dakota or Oregon. It'll say Oregon. And I think that that car is registered. And I think if you look up registration, property, ownership, chosen action, and equitable interest, I think that it'll come clear to you that, no, sir, the Hertz Company doesn't own that car either, that the state of Oregon owns that car. Now, I know it sounds kind of crazy and a little strange, you know, to most people's ears, you know, when you sit down and have a little discussion here, you know, concerning property and property rights and communism and the law of Moses and, you know, the common law and so on, admiralty and equity and Judge Judy, you know, and Judge Wapner. You know, we watch television and we watch Judge Judy and Judge Wapner, and we, honest to God, believe that that's the kind of SH that goes on in the real world. And it's, no, it's not the way the real world works. It's the way television works. It's the way drama works, you know. It's what sells soap, you know, during the middle of the day. You know, you got to have something to keep people's interest, and so you tune into Oprah or Judge Judy. And then sometimes, you know, people call the law school and they say, well, I'm really interested in that, Mr. Gordon. How much is that? And then when I tell them the price, they gasp and they choke and they jump up and down. And they say, that's too much money. Boys and girls, the cheapest law school that I know of in the United States of America is Brigham Young. Probably one of the better ones, too, and they charge less money. Brigham Young out in Brigham City, Utah. 25 years ago, they charged $36,000, $36,000 to go to law school there. Today, I believe, you know, 30 years later, I'll just bet you that it's $70,000 a year, and I've never heard anybody ever claim that law schools were charging too much money. I charge less than a tenth of that, and I can teach you more in 2 weeks than you're going to learn in law school in 5 years. Now, if you want to go to law school and spend $70,000 and spend a lot of time chasing girls and pinching their butts at the water coolers and dinking around at assemblies and putting in tests and one thing and another, college is the place to go, and $70,000 is cheap at the price. But if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty, the truth of the matter is there's 28 things that you need to know in law, 28 things. And it takes me just 9 days or about 30 hours to teach somebody those 28 things. I don't think it takes 5 years. Now, I can remember working in the woods years ago. And we didn't have schools back in those days. I mean, you went out on the job, and you needed to persuade the boss that he ought to give you a try. That was your first hurdle. You had to be able to talk like a Dutch uncle, get the boss to give you an opportunity. If in 5 days working on the job, the boss would come out and he'd tell you, well, I think you got what it takes to make a cat skinner. I think you're going to make a choker setter. I think you're going to make a head loader or a helper or something. He'd tell you. Nor at the end of the week, he'd say, no, I don't think that you're cut out for the woods. I think you probably do better in the mills, or maybe you do better as a machinist, or you might do better as a mechanic. You know, he'd probably give you a little fatherly advice, but, you know, you haven't got the knack, you haven't got the skill, you haven't got the talent to learn how to do this. Today, we send people to school. They send them to law school. That doesn't mean that people that go to law school have any talent for law or any ability in law. We send people to medical school. That doesn't mean that they're going to turn out to be good doctors. They're going to have a piece of paper that says that he's done all the things that doctors are supposed to do or lawyers are supposed to do. But in the final analysis, you know, how many cases do you win? You know, how many bodies do you bury? That's the bottom line. Now, this law school charges less than one-tenth of what it costs to go to real law school. I mean, the big boys. And I don't know very many lawyers understand admiralty any better than the patriots understand it. And it's right here in the law dictionary, and every judge understands it, or any issue that you raise, the judge is going to go to Amjur, or he's going to go to CJS or someplace, and he's going to look it up and say, well, what's the savings to suitors story here? What's that all about? And, you know, number one thing you got to learn how to do here is legal research. Can you look this up and find out what the answer to this riddle is? And the answer is, yeah, I can. I can do that. So here in Section 1, it says origin and nature of admiralty jurisdiction and practice. The nature of admiralty law, number one, says the historical development of admiralty jurisdiction and procedure is of practical as well as theoretical interest, since opinions in admiralty cases frequently refer to the historical background in reaching conclusions on the questions at issue. The special jurisdiction of admiralty has a maritime purpose and is different from the common law, period. Okay, let's talk about that for a second. Admiralty has a purpose, and it's something different from the common law. Well, what are the differences then? It is not exclusively rooted in the civil law system, although it includes substantial derivations therefrom. So the admiralty isn't rooted in the Roman civil law per se, but it certainly got something in common with it. It has a strong international aspect, but it may undergo independent changes in the several countries. Certain features exist in all countries that have an admiralty law, and such international features are given serious consideration by admiralty courts. By the end of the 17th century, the admiralty jurisdiction in England had been restricted until it was not as extensive as in the other European maritime countries, due to a long controversy in which the common law courts, with the aid of Parliament, had succeeded in limiting the jurisdiction of admiralty to the high seas and excluding its jurisdiction from transactions arising on waters within the body of a country. Well, that tells us a little something there. That's Section 1 of Admiralty from Amjur, 2nd edition, on page 720. What volume is this? Volume 2. So there's a clear distinction between admiralty and common law. So patriots have that one right. They're not whistling Dixie. There's something different about these two forms of law. There's a couple other things we should keep in mind, like equity. You know, there's Judge Judy. She's the small claims judge. That's equity. That's where, remember Solomon divided the baby? These two ladies, they came to Solomon, and they said, hey, that's my baby. And Solomon said, okay, well, let's be fair about this. We'll cut the baby in two, and you get the bottom half, and you get the top half. And this lady said, no, that'll kill the child. Give the child to that woman. Don't kill it. And then the other woman said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's kill the baby. So Solomon looked at that, and he said, well, this one woman over here doesn't really care about the welfare or the interest of the child. She's just jealous. And she's motivated by jealousy, and she's willing to kill the child. The other one over there says, well, no, don't kill the child. Go ahead and give it to that woman over there before you kill it. And Solomon, using a little good judgment there, said, I think this baby probably really belongs to the one that wants to preserve its life. In any event, even if that's wrong, it's better for the child to give the child to that mother over there, because this mother over here doesn't care whether this child lives or dies, as evidenced by her own testimony, out of her own mouth, as she condemned herself. And so he said, well, we're going to take the baby, and we're going to give this baby over here to this mother, because this mother over here is concerned about this child's health, safety, and welfare. And of course, we believe that that is the real mother of the child. That's according to the story. You know, we all accept that as being that she's the real mother, and the other one over here was the liar. Now, that's called equity. That's not dealing with any contracts, and it's not dealing with any law. You know, like thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, that's the common law. And if we catch you committing adultery, we don't have to go to any contracts. There's no contract involved. There's this law that says if we catch you committing adultery, we take you out and stone you to death. We don't give you a lethal injection. We don't lock you up for 5 years in the penitentiary. We don't put a big A on your forehead and parade you around in public. We take you out and stone you. That's what the law requires. So the common law is brutal. And it's not kind, and it's not gentle. And I'm not really sure that most of you people out there understand the brutality of the common law. And that's why the common law is about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party. Boys and girls, we have tried the common law. We have tried the law of God. We have rejected it resoundingly. There isn't any country in the world that will accept or will maintain the standards of the common law. I don't know of any state here in the United States that punishes adultery. I mean, punishes adultery. I mean, let alone death. Sabbath breaking is another one. See, if you get caught breaking the Sabbath breaking, the penalty is death. And so the concept of the separation of church and state is well rooted in Anglo-Saxon administration. We want God out of our government, period. We want God out of our law, period. We don't want that guy around at all, as evidenced in 1 Samuel chapter 8, where we kicked him out. Now, of course, we make our choices in life, and those are the choices that have to be made. And then when you make those choices, then there are consequences or results that come from them. You're driving down the highway, and you come up to a sign that says slow to 35. And, you know, you're tooling along at about 70 or 75, and you see this sign says slow to 35, and it's got an arrow, and it's got this 90-degree turn. And you have to make a decision. Should I slow to 35, or should I slow to 55, or should I slow to 45, or should I speed up to 85 or 90? I mean, these are choices that people have to make when they're driving a car. And if you make the wrong choice, well, okay, there's a law called gravity and inertia and force and so on that's going to affect you on this decision. Now, admiralty comes along, and admiralty works on contract. Admiralty is a system of law that is predicated upon contracts. Do you have a contract which would bind you to this admiralty jurisdiction? And most people do. They have social security numbers and driver's licenses, and they have permits or marriage licenses and business licenses and so on. And then they jump up and down and rant and rave and paw the ground, bite the bushes, and do all those things that people do when they're claiming that they've got rights, when in reality there's no rights involved. I'll take a break right here. We'll come right back, and we'll talk about this thing of Siemens papers. Siemens papers. Crazy concept that deals with admiralty right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about admiralty. Patriots get real excited about admiralty and admiralty flags and fringes on the flags and one thing and another. And so I have a little experience along that line, and I have students that come in, and the concepts and understanding that students have typically when they come here to law school is incorrect. Quite frankly, it's incorrect. And so I go over here to the law dictionary, or I go over here to the legal encyclopedia, and I pull out the subject matter and say, okay, well, here's what it is, and here's what it isn't, and here's how it works, and here's how it doesn't work, and here's what it works upon, and here's why it works that way. Now, admiralty is actually a good system. Admiralty is a good system, just like the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a good system for soldiers. I'd like to avoid it if I possibly can. I'm not wild or crazy about admiralty and admiralty jurisdiction, but I know how it works and why it works that way. And so when I get caught up in an admiralty court, I don't jump up and down and yell at the judge. He's an admiralty judge wearing his admiralty hat in an admiralty court in an admiralty case, and I'm a seaman, and so therefore we're gonna talk about admiralty, aren't we? Now, I mentioned before the break there, I said, there's a thing here called seaman's papers. You ever heard of seaman's papers? Well, in the past, I've mentioned this to you. If it went over your head or rolled off your back like water off of a duck, let's think about this for a second. All law is predicated upon contract. And that's why Abraham Lincoln made the observation that government is done by the will of the people. It's done for the people, by the people, or by the people and for the people. And he was referring to the contract, the social contract that we citizens have with the countries that we live in. Now, I'm living here in the United States of America, and I've got a social contract under, oh my God, a number of documents and laws and rules and regulations that, hell, I've never even read. Probably wouldn't be able to find it high noon with both hands in a rudiment. But they're binding upon me because of the social contract. For instance, we got the Constitution of the United States. Then the Congress is enacting laws all the time. And then in addition to Congress, there's state legislatures. They're enacting laws. And then there's the county commission and the cities and city councils. And then special little political subdivisions, like in Idaho, they call them LIDs, L-I-D, Limited Improvement Districts, and they're little political subdivisions. And they can tax you, take your property away from you. They have administrative courts like OSHA and the EPA and the tax courts. You know, the IRS has their own court system. Now, you people in Mexico aren't concerned with any of that, but you've got your own government down there, and you got your own constitutions and laws and rules and social contracts that you've got there, and admiralty works in Mexico. And then you Germans, you know, you've got your legislatures and your Bundestag and whatever you call it over there, and then you've got your social contract. In fact, every country in the world does this. In fact, every country in the world operates off of what we call today the Roman civil law. It's this ancient law that came from the Roman Empire, this resurrection, the seven resurrections of the Roman Empire, and this eighth resurrection coming up. That's this body of law. This is an ancient body of law. Hell, this thing goes back to Babylon and Assyria, this concept, this principle, this contract law. It's been around forever. Now, God has a little different kind of a system over here. The common law is something that operates off of an ultimate contract called the Ten Commandments. See, when God was making this deal with our people, he wasn't thinking about admiralty and savings to suitors and jury trials. He was thinking about a basic law for all of us to live by so that we could all live together, because there were people in the world that were black, see? And Orientals, Chinese, you know, there were people of different races, and he took that into consideration. And we have different kinds of people. You have boy people and girl people, and he took that into consideration. And you have old people and young people, and he took that into consideration. And he forged out a law with only 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. This guy runs the entire universe on this law. And that's all there is to it, 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. Then, if you take those 759 and you divide them out, there's more than one that deal with adultery. And so we come down to subjects of law. Like adultery, there's only 133 of those, 133 subjects of law. Which is more than we have in the U.S. Code. The U.S. Code only has 50 titles or 50 subjects. So God has 133 subjects, 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, runs the whole damn universe. Hell, we've got more law than that just in our tax code, for crying out loud. 2.5 million laws here in the United States. Can you believe that, boys and girls? 2.5 million. And they're all done by contract. You agreed to this. Now, maybe you didn't make an express agreement, but we have a thing called an adhesion contract. Adhesion contracts, that's a contract that maybe you don't know anything about. You don't have to know anything about the terms and conditions of the contract to be bound by those terms and conditions. A warranty, for instance, is an adhesion contract. A driver's license. I mean, you people go down and you sign up for your driver's license, and you sign this application, and you sign this little ticket, you know, that you put in your wallet. Okay, that's your signature. It's your assent to the terms and conditions. But the terms and conditions are written in the statutes, which are in your state code. And you people have never read those 2,000 statutes in your state code. Not a one of you have. I know, I can be pretty cocky and confident, you know. I've never read the 2,000 traffic statutes of the Missouri traffic code. And I'm a law school teacher, for crying out loud, and I've never read all those statutes. And I'll tell you something else. I'll bet you there isn't a highway patrolman in Missouri that's ever read all 2,000 of them. I'll go so far as to say, I bet you there isn't even a legislator, a senator, a representative that's ever read all 2,000 of them. And judges don't read them. The only time that a judge is ever interested in a particular traffic statute is when some highway patrolman brings an action against you and hauls you into court. Then the judge will pull the book down and look at it and say, oh, here's the statute. He'll read the statute and then come in and listen to you lie to him about why it is that you were doing what you were doing. That's the way law works. I mean, We don't sit here, you know, and memorize all these laws and statutes and rules and regulations. Hell, you know, H&R Block, for crying out loud. They don't. Those agents that are working for H&R Block, do you think they've read the entire Title 26 of the U.S. Tax Code? Honest to God, do you believe that they've read the whole thing and they're fully familiar with it, memorized it, and just know it upside down, inside out, and backward? Nobody does. And that's why you get different opinions, you know, concerning the law. But, you know, when a question comes up, we need to research it out and find out, well, now, where does this come down? So here's what Seaman's papers are all about. A seaman is a person who has agreed to the terms and conditions of the contract in that particular area of law. An illustration. One time I was a kid and I wanted to ship out on a ship. So I went down to Fisherman's Wharf, and there's this great big steel trawler. It must have been 150 feet long. I mean, a monster boat. For a fishing boat, you know, it's a monster boat. So I'm walking down the pier, and there's this guy up here on the boat, and I said, hey, are you the captain? He said, yeah. And I said, I'd like to ship out with you. And he said, have you got Seaman's papers? And I said, what's that? And he said, well, son, before you can ship out, you've got to have Seaman's papers. And I said, well, where do you get Seaman's papers? And he said, you get them from the Coast Guard. You go down to, you know, 322 Battery Street, downtown San Francisco, in the Coast Guard office, and they give you Seaman's papers. So I said, well, okay, and if I get these Seaman's papers, have I got a job? He said, you bet. So I could use some help. So I said, well, that's easy enough to do. So I hopped in my car and went down to 322 Battery Street, and I walked into the Coast Guard office, and I said, hey, I need Seaman's papers. The guy says, are you a member of the union? I said, no. He said, well, you can't get Seaman's papers unless you're a member of the union. So I said, well, where's that at? And the guy told me, he said, well, the address for the Seaman's union is down here on 7th Street. And so you go down here to 405 7th Street, and you go into the Maritime Seaman's Union, and they give you, you pay your fee, and you get your union card, and you come down here, we'll give you your Seaman's papers, and you're on your way. I said, well, it's easy enough. So I went down to the union hall, and I said, hey, I need to join the union. The guy says, you got a job? And I said, no. He said, well, you go get a job, and I'll give you your union card, and then you can go down and get your Seaman's papers, and then you can go ship out. So I went back to the ship, and I told him the story, and he said, yeah, that's the way that works. He said, I can't hire you, son, unless you've got a union card. The union, they won't give you a union card unless you got a job. Furthermore, I can't give you a job unless you got Seaman's papers, and you can't get Seaman's papers unless you've got a union card, because this is a closed union shop, and you can't get in. So what kind of justice is this? And it has nothing to do with justice. It has to do with monopoly. Monopoly. And the Seaman's Union has the monopoly. It deals with power, political power, economic power. And government's a part and parcel with these monopolies. You know, so if you think government is going to solve your problem for you, get after it. Go out and vote 3 times in the next election over here if you think government can save you. Government's not your solution. Government's your problem. God told you that clear back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. He says, you know, you people are getting involved in something here that you don't quite understand. And we said, nevertheless, we'll have a king. Okay. Well, boys and girls, when you change your king, you change your law. And when we changed our king, we changed our law from the common law to the civil law. And the civil law develops into this thing called admiralty. Now, here's the development of admiralty in the United States. The admiralty jurisprudence system was brought to America by British settlers, along with the common law and equity. The courts for the administration of the maritime law were commissioned in many, if not all, of the colonies. These tribunals continued the exercise of the power conferred upon them until the organization of the federal government in 1787. Now, before the adoption of the Constitution, jurisdiction in admiralty and maritime cases was distributed between the confederation of the individual states. But when the Constitution of the United States was framed, a system of exclusive federal admiralty jurisdiction was incorporated, placing the entire subject, substantive as well as procedural, under national control because of its intimate relation to navigation and to interstate and foreign commerce. Underline that word, commerce. Because as we're going to see, it derives its power from the Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8. Now, the provision in the Constitution did not abrogate the maritime law, theretofore in force. The maritime law became law of the United States, subject to the paramount power of Congress to alter, qualify, or supplement it as experience or changing conditions might require, subject only to constitutional and treaty limitations. Oh, notice, as changing conditions might require. Admiralty law, boys and girls, changes with the tides. Now, the law of God works like this. God told us, he said, I am the same yesterday, today, and forever. And this is where we get the concept, well, that's in a gray area. See, the law is kind of gray over here. See, we don't quite know what the law is or how that works over here. Now, under the law of God, under the common law, it's black and white. There's no gray areas under the law of God. What is it about adultery that you fail to grasp, son? What is it about thou shalt not steal that you're having a problem with, boy? There's no change in conditions. Theft is theft. And theft is punishable. And it's got spelled out statutes that say, you know, if you steal this, here's the penalty. If you steal that, here's the penalty. And you go over here and you knock this girl up, here's the penalty. You know, you go out here with his neighbor's wife, and here's the penalty. There's no problems with that. And that's because the common law doesn't change. It was brutal when it was enacted. It was brutal when it was enforced. And it's just as brutal today as it was then. That's why we all hate it. But by God, there's no dinking around wondering, well, I wonder how it works or why it works that way or what the penalty is. God imposed the penalty, imposed the law. But he did it with our consent because in Exodus 24, verse 7, he asked the people, he said, now do you agree to this, the terms and conditions of this deal over here? And we said all that the Eternal said we will do and be obedient. So we agreed to it. And by the way, that law is still binding and in full force and effect upon us, in spite of our admiralty, and in spite of our equity, and in spite of our civil law, and in spite of the Romans, you still got this law of God that is paramount. You know, it's still in full force and effect whether you like it or not. And furthermore, it's got natural penalties to it. Natural penalties. See, you and I do not have to enforce the law, the death penalty, against people that practice adultery. That's done with AIDS, herpes, and VD. It's automatic. You got little microbes over here that take care of that. You don't have to be concerned about sodomites over here. The average lifespan of sodomites is 45 years old, a full 30 years less than the average lifespan of Americans today. 39 if they die from AIDS. I mean, once one of these sodomites gets AIDS, that's a death sentence. They got these drugs now, you know, that they're touting. That makes people feel real good. They got these drugs. They'll beat God. See, God said, there shall not be a sodomite of the sons of Israel. And we said, oh, no, God, you got that wrong. We're going to have 10% of us as sodomites. And so we're out here busily sodomizing the country. And so then here comes AIDS, see, and that's killing. And so then the drug companies come along and say, well, we can beat God. We can come up with this drug cocktail. And they're right. That'll beat God for about 5 to 7 years, and then you die. AIDS is a death sentence. Are you going to die in the next year or two or 5 or 8 years? These are the diseases, remember I mentioned to you last week, the diseases of long continuance. Instead of dying quick, we'll kill you over a long period of time, which is suffer. That's why this common law is hated. You know, people hate God and they hate his law because this law is inexorable. I mean, it's going to get you. That's what he told Adam. He said, you'll surely die. You eat off that tree, sucker, and you're going to die. And Adam ate off the tree, and he said, ah, see that? I didn't die. Is Adam alive today, boys and girls? Somebody says, well, he was 930 when he died. Did he die? Well, yeah, he did die, but he was 930 years old. God called a sucker. He said, the day you eat off that tree, you'll surely die. By God, he died. And he went on to say, it's appointed all men to die once. You know of anybody that's been living forever? And so these preachers come on, oh, yeah, see, God lied to you. You got an immortal soul. You're going to live forever. I showed you that last week. That's a damn lie. So Mark Twain used to say, you got liars, damn liars, and then you got statistics. Now, that's one of those damn lies that comes from preachers. Preachers are damn liars. You got fishermen, they're just plain liars. Preachers, they're damn liars. All right, so the changing conditions might require some alterations in this thing called admiralty, subject only to constitutional and treaty limitations. The power of Congress is paramount in matters of maritime law, and it was exercised at an early date when Congress enacted the Judiciary Act of 1789, conferring on the federal district courts exclusive jurisdiction of seizures under the laws of impost, navigation, or trade of the United States, and made on navigable waters within the respective districts. This jurisdiction has since been modified and enlarged by numerous enactments. Whoa, wait a minute. Let's underline, this jurisdiction of admiralty has since been modified and enlarged by numerous enactments. Congress is constantly enacting new legislation that affects admiralty. Boys and girls, this admiralty used to be limited to the high tide mark. But now we see admiralty everywhere. Hell, we see admiralty operating in Kansas City, Missouri, with an ugly anchor woman who is suing because she's been wrongfully discharged. Why is she in an admiralty court, and why is the jury merely advisory? And if this admiralty law deals with ships and water and commerce and things like that, what's it got to do with this woman's wrongful discharge? You ever wonder about that? People will complain to me and say, well, I was in traffic court the other day, and they got this admiralty flag in there. And I always tell them, I say, well, what better place to have an admiralty flag than in an admiralty court? They kind of look at you like, well, what are you, Mork from work? You know, I'm a red-blooded American, and I've got rights. And I got a right to travel, and I got a right to travel without a driver's license. And I agree with them. That's right. You've got a right to travel, and you got a right to travel in the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. And I would contend that the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day is a vehicle under McKenzie in 1914. But, you know, hey, listen, I've been arguing that for 30 years. Well, not 30, but 20. Let's see, how long is 1983? I started 93 years. And I can't get the U.S. Supreme Court to listen to me. Since 1827, when Justice Marshall said, we're not going to listen to mere regulations of commerce, I thought, well, if I could get the Supreme Court to listen to me under Crandall versus Nevada, they would see that this automobile thing over here is out of control. And I contend that it is. And you're right. But do you know what the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day is? It's a horse and buggy. Horses and buggies are not licensed, registered, or insured. But your automobile is. Now, it has been an old common law rule. It goes clear back in ancient times that the king can regulate trade, commerce, business, and industry affecting a public interest on a public right-of-way. But only in the extraordinary and unusual conveyance, not in the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day, where somebody is transporting his own person or property. Boys and girls, we don't have any persons or property to transport on a private on a public right-of-way in the usual and ordinary means. It's unusual and extraordinary, and the Amish are the only guys that are running around, to my knowledge, are still using the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. Now, I would contend that since 1920, the New York Supreme Court said that in McKenzie in 1914 said, well, if the horse and buggy were replaced by the automobile, we'd have a much different case before us. And by 1920, the horse and buggy had been replaced. But the legislatures and the Congress and the courts, they have never changed the usual and ordinary conveyance of the day. And that's what I wanted to change. I wanted to get into court and say, wait a minute, it's time we make this change. And I haven't been successful. So when you go into traffic court, that's an admiralty court, boys and girls, admiralty. By God, they ought to have a French flag in there, don't you think? Yeah, I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And if you'd like more information, why don't you go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.